Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. Today, medical researcher Robert Lustig explains the causes of America's epidemic of heart disease, obesity, and diabetes. It's not lack of exercise, it's not too much fat, it's sugar, plain and simple. And the food industry is shoveling more and more of it down our throats. I hope you'll stay tuned. It's been a dry summer here in darkest Connecticut, and a fairly cool one until last week. Perfect for bicycling. And I have leisure to do bicycling, for I am seasonally unemployed. A generation ago, a person my age would not be unemployed, but retired. But that's not what the new globalized neoliberal economy has brought us, has it? In either case, I've had some time on my hands this summer, and I've spent a lot of it bicycling. The past several years, I've bicycled maybe 200 miles a year. That's not much. This year, I'll probably go well past 1,000 miles. I'm two-thirds of the way there already. I'm now in my mid-60s, and my strength and stamina are increasing a lot slower than they used to. 30 years ago, in late July, I'd be able to bike comfortably for 60, 70 miles a day. Now, 30 miles is a good day's ride for me. Still, that's a big improvement over the recent past. I'm losing some weight, and I'm getting fitter, and my blood pressure is doing well. That's all to be expected from the exercise. Oddly, though, my taste in food is changing, too. I haven't eaten much sugar for years, but now I want it even less. I'm now less attracted to junk food, too, and I find myself skipping the Doritos and grabbing a piece of locally baked whole grain bread instead. And I'm finding more and more that I don't want to eat most of the packaged foods in the supermarket. It all tastes too salty or too sweet or both, especially too sweet. Which brings us to our speaker this week and next. Robert Lustig is a physician, a pediatric endocrinologist, and he's a medical researcher. He is a strong critic of the U.S. food processing industry and its accomplice, the United States government. In his view, America's explosion in weight, obesity, heart disease, hypertension, diabetes, and liver disease are caused primarily by the huge increase of sugar, especially fructose, that the food industry has been shoving down our throats. Fructose is poison, Lustig maintains, but sucrose, ordinary table sugar, is just about as bad. In Lustig's view, the cause of our fatness and our increased bad health is not mainly our inactivity, or salt, or too much fat, or carbohydrates in general. It is fructose. Fructose is now dirt cheap to make, and it is added to just about everything. Of course, the worst offending food is soda pop, and Americans are consuming much more of that than ever before. Fructose is added to infant formula, too, and Lustig reports a growing problem of obese 6-month-old babies. I gather that Lustig's views are controversial among his fellow endocrinologists. I do think his argument is well worth a listen. My friend and fellow radio producer Robin Upton ably edited this talk by Lustig for radio. Find more of Robin at unwelcomeguests.net. Here's the first half of the talk. It's titled, Sugar, the Bitter Truth.
This story dates back about 30 years. This story has a little bit of something for everybody. It has a little bit of biochemistry, a little bit of clinical research, a little bit of public health, a little bit of politics, a little bit of racial innuendo. The only thing it's missing is sex. But we can see what we can do about that too. By the end of the story, I hope I will have debunked the last 30 years of nutrition information in America. And I would very much appreciate it if, at the end of the talk, you would tell me whether or not I was successful or not. Okay? So, in order to get you in the mood, as it were, let's start with a little quiz. What do the Atkins diet and the Japanese diet have in common? The Atkins diet, of course, is all fat, no carb. The Japanese diet's all carb, no fat. They both work. Right? So what do they share in common? They both eliminate the sugar fructose. Okay? So with that, think about what it means to be on a diet and what macronutrients you're eating and which ones you're not, and then we'll go from there and I'll try to explain how this all works. You've all heard about the obesity epidemic. Here are the numbers. These are the NHANES database body mass index. Everybody knows what that is now. Histograms, marching ever rightward as time has gone on. This was what was projected for 2008 in blue. We had so far exceeded and surpassed. This is not even funny. This was from 2003. The reason I show this is not just to show that the obese are getting obeser. Of course, that's true. But in fact, the entire curve has shifted. We all weigh 25 pounds more today than we did 25 years ago, all of us. Now, it is often said that obesity is the ultimate interaction between genetics and environment. And Dr. Christian Vase, who's sitting in the back of the room, will be talking to you next week about the genetic component, which I am also very interested in. But having said that, our genetic pool did not change in the last 30 years. But boy, oh boy, has our environment sure changed. Okay? So tonight, we're going to talk about the environment rather than genes. Okay. Now, in order to talk about the environment, we need to talk about what is obesity. And of course, you're all familiar with the basic concept of the first law of thermodynamics, which states that the total energy inside a closed system remains constant. Now, in human terms, the standard interpretation of this law is the following. If you eat it, you better burn it, or you're going to store it. Now, who here believes that? Oh, come on, you all do. Okay. I used to believe that. I don't anymore. I think that's a mistake. I think that is the biggest mistake, and that is the phenomenon I'm going to try to debunk over the course of the next hour, because I think there's another way to state the law, okay, which is much more relevant and much more to the point. Before I get there, of course, if you believe that, these are the two problems, right? Calories in, calories out. Two behaviors, right? Gluttony and sloth. After all, you see anybody on the street, oh, he's a glutton and a sloth. That's all there is to it. You know, Tommy Thompson said it on the TV show. We just eat too damn much, right? If that were the case, how did the Japanese do this? Why are they doing bariatric surgery on children at Tokyo Children's Hospital today? Why are the Chinese? Why are the Koreans? Why are the Australians? I mean, you know, all these countries who've adopted our diet all suffer now from the same problem. There's another way to state this first law. Okay? And that is, if you're going to store it, that is biochemical forces that drive energy storage, and we'll talk about what they are in a few minutes, and you expect to burn it, that is normal energy expenditure for normal quality of life, because energy expenditure and quality of life are the same thing. Things that make your energy expenditure go up make you feel good, like ephedrine, it's off the market, coffee for 2 hours, then you need another hit like me. Things that make your energy expenditure go down, like starvation, hypothyroidism, make you feel lousy. Okay? And how many calories you burn and how good you feel are synonymous. So if you're going to store it, that is an obligate weight gain set up by a biochemical process, and you expect to burn it, that is normal energy expenditure for normal quality of life, then you're going to have to eat it. And now all of a sudden, these two behaviors, the gluttony and the sloth, are actually secondary to a biochemical process, which is primary. And that's a different way to think about the process. And it also alleviates the obese person from being the perpetrator, but rather the victim, which is how obese people really feel. Because no one chooses to be obese. Certainly no child chooses to be obese. Oh, you say, oh yeah, sure, I know some adults who don't care. You know, Rossini, the famous composer, you know, La Gazza Larga, Marriage of Figaro and all that, he retired at age 37 to a lifetime of gastronomic debauchery. Okay, maybe he chose to be obese. Okay, but the kids I take care of in obesity clinic do not choose to be obese. In fact, this is the exception that proves the rule. We have an epidemic of obese six-month-olds. Now, if you want to say that it's all about diet and exercise, then you have to explain this to me. So any hypothesis that you want to proffer that explains the obesity epidemic, you've got to explain this one too. Okay? And this is not just in America, these six-month-old obese kids, but these are around the world now. Let's talk about calorie intake, because that's what today is about. We're going to talk about the energy intake side of the equation. Okay? Sure enough, we are all eating more now than we did 20 years ago. Teen boys are eating 275 calories more. American adult males are eating 187 calories more per day. American adult females are eating 335 calories more per day. No question. We're all eating more. Question is, why? How come? Because it's all there? You know what? It was there before. There's a system in our body, which you've heard about over the last couple of weeks, called leptin. Everybody heard of leptin? Okay? It's this hormone that comes from your fat cell, tells your brain, you know what? I've had enough. I don't need to eat anymore. I'm done. And I can burn energy properly. Well, you know what? If you're eating 187 or 335 calories more today than you were 20 years ago, your leptin ain't working. Because if it were, you wouldn't be doing it, whether the food was there or not. There's something wrong with our biochemical negative feedback system that normally controls energy balance. And we have to figure out what caused it and how to reverse it. And that's what tonight is about. But nonetheless, there are 275 calories we have to account for. So where are they? Are they in the fat? No, they're not in the fat. 5 grams, 45 calories out of the 275, nothing. In fact, it's all in the carbohydrate. 57 grams, 228 calories. We're all eating more carbohydrate. Now, you all know back in 1982, the American Heart Association, the American Medical Association, and the U.S. Department of Agriculture admonished us to reduce our total fat consumption from 40 to 30%. Everybody remember that? Okay, that's how Entenmann's fat-free cakes came into being. Remember that? So what happened? We've done it. 40% down to 30%. And look what's happened to the obesity, metabolic syndrome, non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, cardiovascular disease, stroke prevalence, all jacked way up as our total fat consumption as a percent has gone down. It ain't the fat, people. It ain't the fat. So what is it? Well, it's the carbohydrate. Specifically, which carbohydrate? Well, beverage intake, right? 41% increase in soft drinks, 35% increase in fruit drinks, fruit aids, whatever you want to call them. Just remember, down here, one can of soda a day is 150 calories. Multiply that by 365 days a year, and then divide that by the magic number of 3,500 calories per pound. If you eat or drink 3,500 calories more than you burn, you will gain 1 pound of fat. Okay? That's the first law of thermodynamics. No argument there. That's worth 15.5 pounds of fat per year. One soda a day is 15.5 pounds per year. Now, you've all heard that before. That's not news to you. The question is, how come we don't respond? How come leptin doesn't work? How come we can't stay energy stable? That's what we're going to get to. So, I call this slide very specifically the Coca-Cola conspiracy. Anybody here work for Coke? Pepsi? Okay, good. All right, so this over here, 1915, the first standardized bottle of Coca-Cola out of Atlanta. Anybody remember this bottle? Sure, a lot of you do, right? I remember this bottle because my grandfather in Brooklyn took me on Saturday afternoon down to the local soda shop on Avenue M and Ocean Avenue, and every Saturday afternoon I had one of these. I remember it very well. Now, if you drank one of those every day, assuming, of course, that the recipe hasn't changed, because, after all, only two people in the world know the recipe, and they're not allowed to fly in the plane at the same time, right? You know that, okay? Assuming the recipe hasn't changed, if you drank one of those every day for a year, 6.5 ounces, that would be worth 8 pounds of fat per year, okay? Now, In 1955, after World War II, and sugar became plentiful again and wasn't being rationed, we have the appearance of the 10-ounce bottle, the first one that was found in vending machines. And you probably remember that one as well. Then in 1960, the ever-ubiquitous 12-ounce can, worth 16 pounds of fat per year. And of course, today, this over here is the single unit of measure, right? 20 ounces. Anybody know how many servings are in that bottle? 2.5 8-ounce servings, that's right. Anybody know, anybody who gets 2.5 8-ounce servings out of that bottle? That's a single serving, right? Okay, so that would be worth 26 pounds of fat per year if you did that every day. And then, of course, over here we have the 7-Eleven Big K Thirst Buster, Big Gulp, whatever you want to call it. 44 ounces worth 57 pounds of fat per year. And if that wasn't bad enough, my colleague Dr. Dan Hale at the University of Texas San Antonio tells me that down there they got a Texas-size Big Gulp. 60 ounces of Coca-Cola, a Snickers bar, and a bag of Doritos, all for 99 cents. Okay, so if you did that every day for a year, that would be worth 112 pounds of fat per year. So why do I call it the Coca-Cola conspiracy? Well, what's in Coke? Caffeine, good, good. So what's caffeine? It's a mild stimulant, right? It's also a diuretic, right? Makes you pee free water. What else is in Coke? Salt, 55 milligrams of sodium per can. It's like drinking a pizza. So what happens if you take on sodium and lose free water? You get thirstier, right? So why is there so much sugar in Coke? To hide the salt. When was the last time you went to a Chinese restaurant and had sweet and sour pork? That's half soy sauce. You wouldn't eat that. Except the sugar plays a trick on your tongue. You can't even tell it's there. Everybody remember New Coke, 1985? More salt, more caffeine. They knew what they were doing. That's the smoking gun. They know. All right, so that's why it's the Coca-Cola conspiracy. So, are soft drinks the cause of obesity? Well, it depends on who you ask. If you ask the scientists for the National Soft Drink Association, they'll tell you there's absolutely no association between sugar consumption and obesity. Okay? If you ask my colleague, Dr. David Ludwig, remember, I'm Lustig, he's Ludwig. Okay? He does what I do at Boston Children's Hospital. Someday we're going to open a law firm. Each additional sugared sweetened drink increase over a 19-month follow-up period in kids increased their BMI by this much and their odds-risk ratio for obesity by 60%. That's a prospective study on soft drinks and obesity, the real deal. If you look at meta-analyses, everybody know what a meta-analysis is? Okay, it's a conglomeration of numerous studies subjected to rigorous statistical analysis. 88 cross-sectional and longitudinal studies regressing soft drink consumption against energy intake, body weight, milk and calcium intake, adequate nutrition, all showing significant associations, and some of these being longitudinal. This came from Kelly Brownell's group at Yale. Okay? I should comment, disclaimer, those studies that were funded by the beverage industry showed consistently smaller effects than those that were independent. Wonder why. Now, how about the converse? What if you take the soft drinks away? So this was the fizzy drink study from Christchurch, England, James et al., British Medical Journal, where they went into schools and they took the soda machines out, okay? Just like we did here in California. We haven't seen the data yet, but they went and did it for a year. So the prevalence of obesity in the intervention schools stayed absolutely constant, no change, whereas the prevalence of obesity in the control schools, where nothing changed, continued to rise over the year. Okay, so that's pretty good. How about type 2 diabetes? Are soft drinks the cause of type 2 diabetes? Well, this study from JAMA in 2004 looked at the relative risk ratio of all soft drinks, cola, fruit punch, and found a very statistically significant trend of sugared soft drinks, fruit aids, et cetera, causing type 2 diabetes. And you know we've got just as big a problem with type 2 diabetes as we do with obesity for the same reasons. And this was a sugared sweetened beverage against risk for type 2 diabetes in African-American women. Looking here at sugared sweetened soft drinks, just the downward arrow shows that there was a significant rise as the number of drinks went up. You can see that here, whereas orange and grapefruit juice, interestingly, did not. Two different studies, two different increases in type 2 diabetes relative to soft drink consumption. So what's in soft drinks? Well, in America, it's this stuff, right? High fructose corn syrup. Everybody's heard of it, right? It's been demonized, something awful. So much so that the corn refiners industry has launched a mega campaign to try to absolve high fructose corn syrup of any problems, which we'll talk about in a moment. Okay, but the bottom line is, this is something we were never exposed to before, 1975, and currently we are consuming 63 pounds per person per year, every one of us, 63 pounds of high fructose corn syrup.
That's American?
That's American, yes. What is high fructose corn syrup? Well, you'll see in a minute. It's one glucose, one fructose. We'll talk about those at great length. One of the reasons we use high fructose corn syrup is because it's sweeter. So here's sucrose. This is cane or beet sugar, standard table sugar, you know, the white stuff. Okay? And we give that an index in sweetness of 100. So here's high fructose corn syrup. It's actually sweeter. It's about 120. So you should be able to use less, right? Wrong. We use just as much. In fact, we use more. So here's lab fructose over here, if you had crystalline fructose. And they're starting to put crystalline fructose into some of the soft drinks. You can, they're actually advertising it as a good thing. And that's got a sweetness of 173. So you should be able to cut that way back, right? They're not. Lactose down here, milk sugar, it's not sweet at all. Okay? And glucose, I should point out over here, is 74. It's not particularly sweet, and we're going to get to that at the end. Okay, and what goes on with glucose. Right? But anyway, there's why we use it. It's sweeter. It's also cheaper, as I'll show you. So here's high fructose corn syrup. One glucose, one fructose. Notice the glucose is a 6-membered ring. The fructose is a 5-membered ring. They are not the same. Believe me, they're not the same. That's what this whole talk is about, is how they're not the same. Okay, and here's sucrose, and they're just bound together by this ether linkage. We have this enzyme in our gut called sucrase. It kills that bond in 2 seconds flat, okay, and you absorb it. And basically, high fructose corn syrup, sucrose, it's a non-issue. It's a wash. They're the same. Okay, and they know that they're the same, the soft drink companies and the corn refiners, because here are their missives. Okay, this comes from the Corn Refiners Association. Obesity research shows high fructose corn syrup metabolizes and impacts satiety similar to sugar. Indeed it does. I agree. At academic meetings around the country. Okay, hunger and satiety profiles energy intakes following ingestion of soft drinks. Bottom line, research supported by the American Beverage Institute and the Corn Refiners Association. They are correct. There is absolutely no difference between high fructose corn syrup and sucrose. So much so that the Corn Refiners Association, in an attempt to capture market share, came out with this entire ad campaign. You probably saw it on the back page of the New York Times. Okay, it was on TV. It's everywhere. My hairdresser says that sugar is healthier than high fructose corn syrup. Wow, you get your hair done by a doctor? I didn't know I could cut hair. If you all want to see all of them, there are a whole bunch of them, you can go to www.sweetsurprise.com and see how you're being hoodwinked. Okay? But indeed, this is true. High fructose corn syrup and sucrose are exactly the same. They're both equally bad. They're both poison. Okay? I said it. Poison. My charge before the end of tonight is to demonstrate that fructose is a poison. And I will do it. And you will tell me if I was successful. Nonetheless, here's Center for the Science and the Public Interest and the Corn Refiners Association. Everybody remember last year when Gavin Newsom floated a soda tax? Governor Patterson of New York has since floated one, and other people are starting to talk about it. So why are they saying this? Well, they're saying obesity is a problem, kids are drinking soda, let's tax it. So they're talking about soda like it's empty calories. I'm here to tell you that it goes way beyond empty calories. The reason why this is a problem is because fructose is a poison. Okay? It's not about the calories. It's not has nothing to do with the calories. It's a poison by itself. And I'm going to show you that. Nonetheless, I just want to read you this paragraph here, okay, in yellow. We respectfully urge that the proposal be revised as soon as possible to reflect the scientific evidence that demonstrates no material differences in the health effects of high fructose corn syrup and sugar. I agree. Here's the important sentence. The real issue is that excessive consumption of any sugars may lead to health problems. Not may, does. Does. So here's the secular trend in fructose consumption over the past 100 years. Before we had food processing, we used to get our fructose from fruits and vegetables. And if we did that today, we would consume about 15 grams per day of fructose. Not sugar, fructose. Sugar would be 30 grams, it would be double. Okay, we're just talking about fructose today. Prior to World War II, we were up to about 16 to 24, about 20 grams. So a small increase from the beginning of the century to World War II. Then, in 1977, just as high fructose corn syrup was hitting the market, we had increased that. We had basically doubled up to 37 grams per day, or 8% of total caloric intake. By 1994, we were up to 55 grams of the stuff per day. Remember, if you want to do sugar, then double the number. So that's 10.2. So you can see that more and more of our caloric intake, higher percentage, is being accounted for by sugar every single year. So it's not just that we're eating more. We're eating more sugar. And for adolescents today, we're up to almost 75 grams, 12% of total caloric intake. 25% of adolescents today consume at least 15% of their calories from fructose alone. This is a disaster, an absolute unmitigated disaster. The fat's going down, the sugar's going up, and we're all getting sick. Now let me show you why. So this is where the politics comes in. This is the perfect storm. And it was created from three political winds that swirled around all at the same time. The first political wind, everything bad that ever happened in this country started with one man. So Richard Nixon, in his paranoia back in 1972, food prices were going up and down and up and down. I'm going to show you that on the next slide. Okay? And he was worried that this was actually going to cost him the election. He admonished his Secretary of Agriculture, Earl Rusty Butts, I love that name, to basically take food off the political table, to make food a non-issue in presidential elections. Well, the only way to do that was to make food cheap. So he was out to find all methods to be able to decrease the price of food. Remember Nixon's war on poverty? We're suffering from it today.
We've been listening to endocrinologist Robert Lustig with part one of Sugar, the Bitter Truth. Thanks again to Robin Upton at unwelcomeguests.net for the audio. And thank you for listening to New World Notes. We come to you from the spacious underground studios of WWUH-FM, a community service of that beacon of light in darkest Connecticut, the University of Hartford. NewWorldNotes.blogspot.com. On behalf of the entire New World Notes staff, this is Kenneth Doust, advising illegitimi non-carborundum, support your local bike shop, remember that war is not healthy for children and other living things, and please come back again next week. Ciao.